Okay, so welcome to another episode of Garden State CoachCast. I'm your host, Mick Hughes. Today, I'm lucky enough to be joined by Chris Mongilia, Director of Basketball Operations at Princeton University. So, Monge, welcome.
Thanks, Mick. Thanks for having me, man.
And that is your nickname, correct? How many people around here or in your life call you Chris? A lot, or?
My family basically calls me Chris. And okay. That's about it.
I know you obviously through the team camps and things like that, and basically everyone that I've ever come across that knows you calls you Monge. So we'll just go with that for the rest of the podcast.
Let's do it.
So let's just start out. What's your background in basketball? How did your experience inform kind of how you fulfill this role? I know that your title is Director of Basketball Operations, but I know you do a lot on the basketball end in terms of interacting with the guys and helping them do workouts and stuff. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about, you know, how it all started for you.
Sure. Background in basketball, just really fell in love with the game at a young age. My dad was a football coach. I always loved basketball. It just kind of worked out that way. My experiences informed me how to be a coach basically through my dad and through my mom. My mom wasn't a coach, but she was a teacher. My dad was a teacher. So I grew up around kind of, you know, that demographic and that discipline. My aunt was a softball coach, mm-hmm. also a teacher. So I grew up in schools. I grew up at practices. I grew up around dinner table discussions about, you know, discipline and coaching, discipline in the classroom. So that's probably a big foundation of who I am and how I've gotten into the coaching side of things. But my background in basketball basically was, you know, an average high school player who just really, really loved the game. I don't think I ever watched basketball as a fan. I think I always watched it as, you know, a learning opportunity, trying mm-hmm. to grow, trying to figure out, you know, why kind of Roy Williams did this or why Coach K did that. That's always been my approach. And it's really kind of been like that now, obviously being in the profession of coaching, always trying to learn something from somebody else.
Yeah. And that's a big reason too, why I started the podcast is to learn from different coaches and to obviously use this as a resource for other coaches out there who are listening, particularly younger coaches who want to get into coaching on any level, whether it be middle school, high school, you know, collegiate level. And so you're going to, I feel like you give us a great look into really what's going on at a high level college program. So coaches in the family, what ended up being your first coaching job?
My first coaching job was at Riverdale High School up in Bergen County, New Jersey. I was looking to get into coaching around 23 years old. Didn't have a lot of contacts. Didn't play in college. Didn't play for a prestigious high school that had a lot of connections at the collegiate level. So I started at high school. Coach Brian Long was a Dumont resident, which is where I'm from. He was coaching at Riverdale. I grew up with his son, Travis. So that was a natural connection for me to just reach out to him and say, hey, just looking to volunteer. I wasn't looking to be a freshman coach or a JV coach, just wanted to get involved and kind of reintroduce basketball back into my life. You know, it's been out of it for at that point 5 years since I had played high school basketball. So that was my first job. And I volunteered at every level. I was freshman volunteer, JV volunteer, varsity, but really latched on with the freshman coach at the time, Adam Fasandola, who let me really experiment when he had no reason to. And that was really huge for me. He trusted me and we worked really well together. And that kind of invigorated me into coaching a little bit more.
Yeah, I think giving, especially as a young coach, if somebody shows some confidence in you and lets you like play around and, you know, try out some different things, that's a great way to learn and to, you know, figure out what works and what doesn't. And, you know.
For sure.
So, go ahead.
I think like, the biggest thing for me was I had wanted to coach my whole life for basketball, and mm-hmm. that's just always what I wanted to do. And I always was like drawing up plays or figuring out how I would do a practice. So I had a lot of ideas in my head mm-hmm. walking into it. So I think, yes, Adam let me do all that stuff, and I was really fortunate, but he also let me do it because he felt like I was prepared. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't just walking in there and, you know, I think a lot of guys on social media nowadays are doing all these drills with cones and bean bags mm-hmm. and all this stuff. And I'm just like, where are they getting it from? What's their source? You know, I came with some concrete ideas. And I think Adam was like, yeah, it sounds good. Like, let's go with that. Mm-hmm. So, Riverdale was like the best thing that ever happened to my career. Obviously, it's where I started, but Ronnie, the head coach there, and Adam let me do so much in that program. They let me run individual workouts with the guys, even when the coaches weren't around. Strength and conditioning stuff. They gave me the reins and were like, hey, if you want to do it, like, get after it and get our program better. And it was a lot of trial and error for me of what worked and what didn't work. And it was huge for my development.
Let me ask you, so, and you got into it, you said, as a young guy at 23, how did you get the players to, I guess, trust what you were doing in terms of, like, especially let's talk maybe, let's say, individual workout, right? So, you know, here's this guy, you're not much older than the players. How did you get them to be like, oh, okay, coach wants to get us better here and we're confident that he's going to do that? Were there certain things that you brought to the table that you think, you know, allowed them to trust you in that regard?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So I think early on, I can't really remember how I did it in my first year. I think I was very enthusiastic. I think I was fairly well informed at that point in my career. Now being where I am, that's like almost 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think about how much stuff I didn't know, but at that point I was very confident in what I did know. And I think that belief rubbed off on the players in that first year as a volunteer. My first year as a middle school coach, I think it was my own team and I knew it was going to be my own team for a while. So I was severely prepared for how I wanted my tryout to go, how mm-hmm. I wanted my teams to play. And I think the command that I demanded early on in the tryout stage of, I mean business, this is how we're going to do it.
Yep.
You know, not being a dictatorship, but understanding like I'm very, very sure of how this is going to happen. And then we had a really talented team that year and we didn't lose a game the whole season. So that really helped me as well.
You know, sure.
It had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with the players. But the fact that we were not losing and we were winning games by a lot just helped people believe and buy into what my message was. So that just supplemented my confidence at that mm-hmm. time.
And, oh, for sure. I mean, everybody loves a winner, you know.
For
so
sure.
That's I'm sure you know that. We all know that. And so, yeah, success, that'll definitely give you trust, you know. If you're seeing success on any level, especially if you're not losing a game, then yeah, people will definitely trust you. So how did you get the job at Princeton? Obviously this is a place with a lot of history. It's got a, you know, storied Hall of Fame coach in Pete Carril, multiple Ivy League championships. So how did you get this job?
The expedited storyline of that is I fell in love with coaching basketball at Riverdale.
Okay.
And had an opportunity to be the head coach at my high school, which I had always dreamed about being, you know,
yeah,
build a state championship program there.
Sure.
At a really young age, and didn't get the job and always wanted to go to college, and kind of just decided I didn't get my one dream. Like, I'm going to go after presumably a harder dream going to the college level. And really dedicated my time to that and my resources to that. We brought our team camp there when I was at Riverdale. We brought them to team camp here at Princeton.
Uh-huh.
And Brett McConnell, who's our associate head coach now, who was in my role at the time, him and I communicated. He was really great in giving me advice on how to get into the college level. I got hooked up with an AAU program, coached AAU basketball, 16U level. The 17U coach was the head coach at Kane University, Rob Krasinski. Him and I hit it off. On a trip out to Pittsburgh, he was like, hey, what do you want to do with your career? I was like, I really want to coach in college. And by the end of the trip, he was like, you know, I don't have money to give you, but if you want to come on board, I can create a spot for you. And took that kind of leap of faith to join Rob and Tom Wagenblast, who's the head coach at the College of St. Elizabeth now.
Mm-hmm.
They were tremendous assets for me in terms of, you know, Riverdale was where I kind of experimented. And I think Kane is kind of where I learned a lot about what it meant to be a college basketball coach, what it meant to be a researcher of basketball. That was huge in my development. And oddly enough, Tom and Brett were college roommates.
Hmm.
They were managers at Rutgers, so they were very, very close friends. So Brett had known about me, hooked me up with the AAU program a little bit, but all along was, you know, obviously getting updates on how I was doing from
mm-hmm.
Tom, who was a good friend of his. So I think my work at Kane really helped solidify my reputation through Brett's lens. and allowed him to know through Tom, like, hey, this kid's doing a good job, or he's working hard, he's recruiting his tail off, and so on and so forth. So from there, I got an opportunity to go to St. Peter's. I did that for 1 year. John Dunn and Matt Henry, the two coaches there that really taught me a lot about how to run a program on a really low budget. Coach Dunn, how to build a defense and how to do some of those things there. His attention to detail was second to none. He was a really, really important stop for me along in my career. I always say to people, like, I left there too soon. Now I left for Princeton, so it worked out pretty well. But I could have used another 2 or 3, maybe even 4 years with Coach Dunn, with how much knowledge he has and how good he runs his programs. Then when that kind of wrapped up, throughout that whole time, I was working camps here at Princeton. I was working their little kid camp, you know, almost babysitting first graders and second graders, doing their elite camps when I could. Brett would offer me to come to practice. I would show up. He would offer me tickets to a game. I would show up, letting him know, like, this is not just another guy who emailed you who wants to be a college coach. This is someone who means business, and I'm dedicating my time and my resources to making it happen. So when this job opened up here, I got an interview and made the most of it. And that's kind of the history of it. Built the right kind of relationships, made the right kind of decisions, and got a little lucky.
I mean, the one common thread that seems to, it goes through your journey is the willingness to volunteer, you know, and to come in and, you know, just grind, you know, work, obviously, and clearly it worked, you know, clearly it worked, because I think this is, I mean, you're doing a great job here, and this is really just a great place to be a part of. And so that kind of brings me, so what do you think in your eyes? So how many years, is this your fourth year here?
Going into year four.
Into year four. So having been here for 4 years, what do you think makes Princeton special? Because I know a lot of people, when they come here, I know when I walk into Jad, when there's, I don't know, something, you can feel something in the air. It's a little different. You know, you have the Bill Bradley statue out front. And so what do you think makes it special?
Yeah, I think I see the 27 titles when you walk in over the court. That's what kind of hit me the first time I came in here. I think the standard of the school, not necessarily like the basketball program or the athletic department. I think just the place that Princeton is in general is all about excellence. You know, when you hear Princeton, I tell people where I work and they're like, oh, like there's like a little bit of a shock factor when I tell people that. Maybe they don't know. They think I'm not smart enough to be here or something like that. That could be it. But they're taken back by that. But I think the standard of excellence around this whole campus is definitely what makes it different. And I think the people that are here are kind of what separates this place from other places. The rare combination of people that know that the bar is excellence, and the people that are willing to try and reach that bar and even go past that bar, is what makes this place really, really fun to be around.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just the architecture alone, you know, that's why I love bringing our guys here for team camp, because, you know, they get a chance maybe as a freshman, sophomore, junior to like walk around a campus that's filled. I'm like, guys, this is literally one of the 3-4 best colleges in the world, and you get to be here for 2 or 3 days. And I think there is something inspiring, because you're like, was Einstein walking around here when he thought of some crazy idea? Like, those are things that I think about when I'm here. So yeah, it's really, really is a special place. So let's just talk about this. What does a day in the life of a basketball operations guy look like? You know, try to walk our audience through what your typical day. Let's say we'll go in season. I know you're off season right now and your calendar is full.
Yeah.
So in season, middle, you know, what's it look like for you?
It's honestly like the most popular question that I get when I talk about, obviously, what my title is or what my job is. And I think you hit the nail on the head. It depends on what season we're talking about. Is it summer? Is it preseason, postseason, in season? So my favorite part is in season, because there's a lot more structure. There's a lot more. I know what my day is going to look like. Out of season and in the summertime, there's a lot of variable of where I could go and what I could do. In season, probably getting in the office anywhere between 7:15 and 7:45. I like to try to get in early and get what's definite on my checklist done.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's an expense report, whether that's watching practice film from the day before, whatever on my checklist that morning, no one usually bothers me or tries to email me or call me from 7:30, you know, up until about 10 o'clock. So in that time, that's like my time. So whatever I know I need to get done, I can have the liberty to get that done in that time. And then believe it or not, at 10 o'clock, I go and work out, get a workout in the gym. Coach Henderson's great about, making sure our staff is staying healthy and taking care of themselves. And that's a priority for him. And it's a priority for really everyone on our staff, which is great to be around. So I kind of go and get that done. And then 11 o'clock hits. If we're in season, our staff is probably meeting around that time. We'll probably talk about practice the day before, talk about practice coming up that day, or whatever the case may be. If there's a game coming up, we're probably talking a little scout. So that meeting can go anywhere from a half hour to an hour and a half. We don't usually go too long while we're in season because we know everyone's kind of got some things to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Coaches maybe have to cut up film for a player or whatnot. So that's kind of that range. And then somewhere around 1 o'clock until 4 is some combination of, do I have a marketing meeting? Do I have a business meeting? Do I have a Princeton Varsity Club meeting? What does that look like in there? I'll usually schedule my meetings probably around 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock time frame. Then there's a practice preparation to go into that, you know, making sure film's set up and ready to go, making sure we have all the resources that we need if we have pads that day, checking the practice plan for, you know, do we need cones? Do we need scout uniforms? What's on the schedule that we need to be prepared for when practice hits? And then around 4:15, our guys start rolling in. And then I try to be present in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that's going on is kind of shut out in my mind, or at least I try to. And talk to our guys when they walk in. They just took, you know, nuclear physics or, you know, some class up campus that they can't wait to get in the gym, and they're walking in hopefully excited to see us. So I try to spend that time with our players. And then practice will go anywhere until, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. And then from there, it's kind of up in the air. I tried recently, I've been doing a better job of not bringing work home and just getting all my work done. That's why I get into work early in the morning, because I say what normally people would do at home when they get back at mm-hmm. 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
I'm kind of doing that stuff in the morning time to try and separate things a little bit. But that's an average day in the middle of the year.
I mean, you know, there's a couple of things. Like, so I personally, I'm an early riser as well. And I think I just find myself more productive in the morning, like a little more focused or whatever. And at night, kind of the opposite. So I can see where you're coming from on that. But you brought up the idea, and this is you getting stuff done in the morning, kind of not bringing it home and finding balance. So, you know, that's obviously one way. And, you know, we're talking, these are high stakes. You know, you're playing for – it's a Division I basketball program. You know, winning is so, so important. So how do you, you know, is there something you do that just balances you out, lets you maybe escape for a little bit from the day-to-day of this whole job? Like, how do you do that? I know you said working out is a big part of it, and that makes a ton of sense. But anything else you do that just kind of lets you, like, clear the slate for a little bit?
Yeah, I think the number one thing that I would say helps me find balance is I'm very intentional with my decisions on what I'm doing on a daily basis. What's really important to me? Is it texting my sister? Is it FaceTiming with my niece and nephew? Is it calling my family?
Mm-hmm.
Is it texting some of my friends to keep in touch with them? Those are the things that in this business, if you allow it to, you'll lose that. So making sure that stays a priority and keeping in touch with people is important to me. You know, when I was 18, 19, and 20, I would tell you like, oh, I would escape by going to play, you know, NCAA football on my PlayStation. But that's gone. That doesn't happen anymore. So that was really important to me back then. Now you fill in what's important to you and what do you need to make sure you're keeping in your life. So the habits that I'm creating, like how are you creating habits for yourself? The habit of waking up early is something that I've decided is important to me because I want to get work done. And then I want to be able to make sure I don't miss a workout. So when I first got here, I was skipping workouts because I used to work out early in the morning, like first thing when I was in St. Peter's. But now our athletes are in there in the morning here, so you can't get into the gym. And then I would be like, oh, I'll just work out after practice. And like, I don't have the energy to do that at 7 o'clock at night.
No.
So I've created a habit for myself to say, working out is really important to me. I'm going to plug it in. Here's how I'm going to do it. And I'm being very intentional about how I do that. So those are the things. I don't really have too many hobbies. I like to read.
Yeah.
Been trying to create a habit of reading like 25 pages every night. I'm in the middle of that right now. I think it's a good habit I've started and can tear through a couple books on that habit alone. So that's kind of what I do when I go home.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think there's anybody out there who's gonna be like, hey, reading's no good for you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like
for sure.
That's, but you know, and there, but and the other thing with reading, the challenge becomes like, there's so many things like Netflix, Amazon Prime, you got all these, you got a million shows and everyone's like,
there's
hey.
Some Netflix in there too. Don't get it twisted. Right. I'm not like, I'm not going home and burning books every night. There's a couple of Netflix shows to keep it loose in there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned before the part of your day around 4:15, the players start walking in. And I think too, just probably to even backtrack a little bit beyond that, is like the idea about being intentional. I think that that's really something that young coaches should, really everybody should really think about that. You know, we all have limited time. Everybody's very busy. And being intentional, I think, is a great way to figure out what's important and what's not. So good on you for really putting that into action in your life. So again, kids walk in about 4:15, or the guys, you know, how do you go about building relationships with players? Like you said, you want to be real present during that time. Like, you know, I know there's no four steps to doing it, but like, what are some ways that you think are effective in terms of developing the relationships with your players?
I think there's every person that answers the question is always going to say like, show them that you care.
Right.
So like, how do you do that? Everyone's going to tell their players that, you know, oh, I care about you. I do this, I do that. Like the proof is actually doing actions that show that you care about them and genuinely caring about them. I'm lucky enough that sometimes I can go to lunch with them. Like I'll go up to a dining hall and I'll text, you know, Jerome or Ryan and be like, hey, what time are you free today?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be like 12:30. I'm like, all right, cool. Let's meet at Whitman. Let's grab something to eat and like not talk about basketball.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a huge thing here, Mick, is our guys love to debate. They love to, they love to say who's your Mount Rushmore of all time athletes.
Right.
Like that's a huge one that they talk about. They do. They like hypothetical questions and say like, if this, what would you do? And that's what they like to do. And that's how like spend time in that and argue with them and joke around with them. And that spending time with them is what I think really is how you build the relationship. Obviously we want Jerome and Ryan to make a lot of shots and make a lot of stops on defense, but they're not really going to give their maximum effort until they're bought in on the coaches that actually care about them. There's a saying, make sure I get this right. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just tell them you care. You have to just do some actions that are showing like, hey, I'm invested in your well-being outside of basketball. And there's really, like you said, there's no four-step thing to mm-hmm. follow. It's just got to be genuine. And you can't fake it because kids are too smart these days. They'll know.
Hey, I baked you a cake, guys.
Right. Don't bring them cookies.
Right. So practice, you know, you talked about watching the prior day's practice on film. So to you, what does a good practice look like? What do you guys try to do? Is it more skill stuff, concept stuff, situations?
Mm-hmm.
And then once you do have that practice, what are you looking for on the film like the next day to use in your practices?
I think our practices have you have skills, concepts, and situations. I think we have a good blend of that. I think obviously here we pay attention to detail. Anyone who's heard Coach Henderson give a lecture or speak or come to a practice will know that he's very detail oriented in how things get done. How our offense starts passing the correct way. If the pass is off, he'll let you know about it, make you redo it. So very skill oriented in that. We shoot a ton here. We'd like to make shots, and hopefully practicing making shots is going to get us some victories. So there's a good component of skill here. And like I mentioned, if a guys are walking to the gym at 4:15 and practice doesn't start till 4:45, we're actually lucky enough to be able to do a little bit of the skill work there.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we don't have it in our practice plan, but we make our guys know that you need to get down here on a day where you don't have class till 4:20.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get down here at 4 o'clock and get some skill work in, because that's the time for Princeton basketball when we can really sharpen the blade.
Yeah.
Is during those times when maybe it's not in the practice plan, but we know we're getting that skill work in during that time. Conceptually, I think we spend a lot of time on concepts. Just the way we play is a lot of 3-man and 2-man actions, not really, you know, a structured offense, but there's ways to play and there's ways to do things. So we spend a lot of time on concepts and reads. That's something, you know, the second part of your question was, what are you looking for on film?
Mm.
And that's something we're looking for. Did you make the right read? Mm. Like, did he go under the screen? If he did, how come you didn't stop behind it and get the ball and shoot it?
Mm-hmm.
Did he trail the screen? He trailed it. Why didn't you curl this? So mm-hmm. we do a lot of correction like that on stuff, and our players are pretty well versed on. They know, like, there's times where our players will come off the court and they'll be like, I didn't read that right. I know it's going to be on film tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're already ready for it. And then situations is like, it's something I love to do. It started back when I was in high school coaching. Like I said, Adam and I at Riverdale had a really good relationship, and I was coaching freshmen and he was coaching JV. And there were times where I was big on situations. I always thought it was fun. I thought the kids liked it. I think, like, if you're a coach, I think you're always like in a dream situation. Okay, it's the state championship. I'm down by 2. Like, you always kind of did that. And if you were a kid playing outside in front of your hoop, I was always pretending to be, you know, Michael Jordan with the game on the line and Craig Elo shooting over him. Like,
right.
Those are all things you did. So when I was a coach, I was like, why would I not
mm-hmm.
bring that to life? And I would invite Adam to my practice, and he would coach my second team and I would coach my first team. And we would have a kid put a random situation on the board and we would just go. And I didn't know what it was, and Adam didn't know what it was. And we would have to talk through that. And we kind of brought that to Princeton, and we do that here pretty often. Coach Henderson does not know what's going to happen. I'm literally the only one in the building who knows what's going to happen. I'll throw a situation up on the scoreboard. I'll verbalize it to the team about, you know, how many team fouls mm-hmm. and situations yep. like that. What's the possession arrow? We'll give all that out to them. And what's great is Coach Henderson gets his 30 seconds or 45 seconds with the guys. And usually Brett's the other coach on the black team that's mm-hmm. that's doing that. And what you see is the guys get on the court and they still have more talking to do. Coach Henderson didn't get to everything.
Right.
And it forces our players to talk and put themselves in those situations as well. A cool little story that I can say here is, 3 years ago now, we went to the Ivy Championship game. And that week in practice, this is a semifinal game. We're playing Penn. And that week in practice, we had done the exact situation that happened in that game. We were down by two. Penn was on the line, shooting 1-1. Kid misses the shot. We literally did that same exact situation earlier that week in practice. And it won us a game. Miles came down, tipped the ball in, and tied it, sent it to overtime. So it was really cool to see that happen and situations show up in games like that. And it won us a game, and it led us to an Ivy tournament title and NCAA tournament bid. So
yeah,
that's the proof is in the pudding there.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing. Well, you know, they say the more prepared you are, the luckier you are. Is a prime example of that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Princeton basketball's culture. How do you think it's different than other programs, or what sorts of things that are valued here that really, really make it, you know, this is a Princeton thing. This is our culture. These are our core beliefs. This is what we believe in.
I think the connection to the past is probably what makes Princeton very different here. Obviously, I, you know, talked about before the 27 Ivy League titles that we have here. It's a big part of this place. It hangs over your head every time that you're on the practice court. So you're reminded of it. You know about it. It's probably a component of why you chose to come here if you're a player. So you're very well aware of that. And our alums are very connected to the program. They're constantly on our social media pages checking in. We have, you know, golf outings, and we've traveled around the country, and we're lucky enough to see a lot of them. You know, they're nationally located. So we've gone to California. We've had, you know, a Princeton alumni event. We played in Hawaii 2 times, and we've had 2 Hawaii Princeton alumni events. So it's really cool to see that we have that support all around the country. And it's also amazing, like, you know, you're in Hawaii and people are talking about, oh, we saw this graphic that you posted last week. And I'm like, oh man, like, these people really care about how we're doing. And it's really, really cool. Last year we had a really, really good team 50 years ago, class of 1969 season. And it was the 50th anniversary of their season. And they all came back to a game and we recognized them during a game. They had some stuff on the video board. But the day before, Coach Henderson invited him to practice. And these guys played, they literally played here 50 years ago.
Right.
And like, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they were all in there. There was about 10 or 11 of them. And they were so happy to see each other. Some people hadn't seen each other in a bunch of years. And we were practicing and those guys were, you know, going at it on the sideline, chirping back and forth, just enjoying the fact that they were at a Princeton basketball practice. And then after the practice was over, all of our players went over to talk to them. And it was really in that moment that hit me to see the interactions that were going on. These people were 50 years apart from each other and talking like they had known each other their whole lives. And I was talking to Elijah Barnes while this was going on. And him and I were like, you realize that when these guys played here, some of the parents of our current players were like barely born. They were like maybe like 2, 3, 4, or 5 years old. And to see that the connection just lasts over time and the investment of this is where I was when, you know, I played here in 69 and now you're here. We're no different. You know, the shorts might look a little different. The jerseys are a little different. There's a giant video board hanging over your head when you played. Like, we didn't have that in the 60s, but the bond of going through this place and getting an education and playing for a prestigious program like that, that transcends time.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just kind of the power of sports too, power of being a teammate is, you know, that, I mean, when you can pick up, I mean, anything, like that's a sign of a good friend is like if you haven't seen each other in 10 years and you just pick up like no time has gone by, and it kind of sounds like the way you're describing those guys.
For sure.
It forms really, really strong bonds. And I'm sure that was great for your guys to then see that and to for them to kind of take in how powerful the bonds that they're forming now will be, you know, hopefully later on in the future. So
right.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. So, you know, and when you just said like those guys are remembering going through here, getting an education. And so the Ivy League, obviously very academically demanding league. So what are the biggest challenges in your eyes coaching in the Ivy League?
I think time is probably the biggest challenge for us. Obviously, our players have an academic requirement that they have to make sure that they're getting done. And I understand that's no different than other schools. But these guys are going to Princeton, which is a little bit more challenging than some of the other schools. No different than our league. Everyone in the league is doing the same thing. But just being aware of their time and understanding they have to go eat, they have to go do homework. They're coming from class, just understanding that we have to operate from a practice perspective in a pretty, not short, but strict timeline of this is when we get them and this is when we have to make the most of our time with them. Travel-wise, we have to miss as little amount of class as possible. So we're always worrying about how many classes are we going to miss. We can't schedule that game because we'll miss too many classes. So we're always worried about that. And I think the biggest thing for us is the time that we don't get with them in the summertime. So we're not allowed to work out with them over the summer. And in ways like a lot of high school coaches will say to us like, oh, you guys have so much more time with them because you're a college program, which is like, couldn't be further from the truth. In the off season, when we're in school, we're only allowed 2 hours a week with them on the court, which 2 hours is a lot, but it's not that much time. And then in the summertime, Ivy League rules, we're not allowed to work out with our players at all. Now, if you're going on a foreign tour, you're allowed to have 10 practices prior to going. But in the summertime, we don't see our guys. And I remember in high school, like, that was my favorite time when I was coaching.
Oh, yeah.
We had open gyms. Kids could come in at 7 a.m. and do an individual workout before camp. Like, you had a lot of access to your players. I don't think you could make it mandatory, but back then, I remember at Riverdale, we would have, you know, full gyms. And, like, that's what I love about coaching. We don't get that here. And then, you know, we have to go play a team in the non-conference that's been having summer workouts that gets to campus before our team does. We start late here at Princeton. Our first day of class is until September 11th.
Oh, wow.
So I've seen online some teams are already moving into their dorms. So that means they're going to have 6 or 7 weeks of preseason before the first official practice starts. We're going to have about 2.
Right.
So we're always behind the 8-ball when it comes to that. So I think being very, very smart with the time that we have with our players is probably the biggest hurdle here in the Ivy League.
Hmm. One question I've asked, I think I asked you this before, but you know, for our listeners, I just always think it's interesting in terms of the Ivy League schedule, how, you know, you guys don't, when it gets to the regular season anyway, you don't play during the week and you play back-to-back games on Friday, Saturday. So in terms of the preparation for, you know that you're playing back-to-back games. How does that affect, you know, let's say the way you prepare for those teams? Do you try to blend each team into every practice, or are you, this is a Penn practice, this is a mm-hmm. Brown practice, or, I don't, you know?
So whoever we play on Friday night, whoever we play on Saturday night, we'll scout for them on Monday and Tuesday. So everything in practice will be, let's just use Yale Brown, for example. That's who we'll play in a weekend. Okay. So if we play Yale on Saturday, Monday and Tuesday will be geared towards Yale. And then Wednesday and Thursday will be geared towards Brown, since they'll be the Friday night opponent.
Yeah.
So some people will argue, like, Yale goes right out the window once you start getting into Brown, and our players will forget all about it. And then we serve Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon as more of a refresher of, like, mm-hmm. hey, remember this for Monday, remember this for Tuesday. So that's how we attack the Ivy League season.
Hmm. Yeah, I just thought it was really – I'm like, man, this has got to be tough in that way. So Coach Henderson obviously was a great player. Princeton, he's an all-Ivy performer, member of the 1996 team that upset UCLA, you know, speaking of history, in the first round of the NCAA tournament. What's it like working for Coach, and what does he do that you think makes the program successful?
It's great to work for Coach Henderson. He's very, very in touch with understanding our needs as assistant coaches and, like, support staff, and how, you know, he's always cognizant of our time. Like, he's very aware of our players' time, but he's also very aware of our time. As coaches professionally, like, he knows that we have a lot of stuff to do outside of just the basketball here, but also personally making sure that, you know, you're getting time off, you're not doing too much, you're not burning out. So in that sense, it's very refreshing in a business where people can be, like, demanding. And I've heard stories of programs where coaches demand that the phone be answered at all times, and keeping someone in the office overnight to answer it if it rings. Like, I've heard stories like that.
Yikes.
And I've been lucky enough to not have to work for anyone like that. But Coach does a great job of that. And he holds us to a very high standard, and he doesn't have to say that to us, but we know that he's expecting us to be sharp. He's expecting us, if we're talking, make sure that you're basing it off of fact and not off of an opinion. Have some meat behind what you're bringing to the table, which is it's a great spot to work in and do that. What makes the program successful is obviously he played here, like you said. I think he understands the place really, really well, better than, you know, anyone could. They were tremendous when he played here. They were ranked in the top 10 in the country when he was a player here. They won 3 Ivy League titles during his time here. So he exudes excellence. Like, he's all about that. I think the way he can relate to our players of what they're going through is second to none. It helps us. He understands, like, we can't do this because they're coming from that. He knows all that. And his attention to detail, I talked about it earlier in the podcast, but, like, that's really, really kind of his sweet spot. Like, he'll see things more quickly than any of the coaches on our staff. Now I've been here for a while, so I'm starting to pick up on what he sees just as fast as he does, which is great. But I think that's like since he's like that, it rubs off on us and it makes us all better coaches just being around that and being able to see all that stuff. And his coaching of 3-on-3 is like the best in the country.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good. It's like a clinic every time that we play 3-on-3. He'll see things. And now when I first got here, we would do 3-on-3 and he would stop it all the time. I'd be like, I don't get why he's stopping it. What is he seeing?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm at the point where like I'll see a guy do something and I'll be like, he's going to stop it. And then he then he stops it. So his coaching of 3-on-3, his coaching of reads, his coaching of how to play, how to cut, how to move, how to space, like he's really, really good at that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he obviously played himself under, you know, Pete Carrillo, one of the masters. So I'm sure he heard so much from that. And now with all his experiences as well and, you know, sharing it with you guys, that's got to be a really incredible learning opportunity in addition to, you know, enjoying your job. So I get Princeton won the Ivy League regular season and the Ivy tournament in 2017, and you guys came within a whisker of upsetting Notre Dame in the NCAA tournament that year. What made that team so special in your eyes?
Oh, man, I have flashbacks anytime anyone brings up the Notre Dame game about how close we were to pulling that one off.
Sorry. It was a great game. It was like it was like a 2 o'clock.
It was the first game of the tournament that year.
First game of the tournament.
We let off the whole thing. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there was a stat. I'm not going to remember it, but like it was the most streamed game that year.
Yeah.
Obviously, because everyone was tuning in to game number one.
Right.
And it was a close game. So everyone was like pulling for the upset. But yeah, that team was really special. I think the number one thing that happened for that group was there was a great core coming back from a really successful team the year before. I think they had gone – I'm trying to think. I wasn't here that year.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were 12-2 in the league, so they had a really good season. They had lost the league the year before by one game and really like one or two plays. So there was a lot of expectation and senior leadership coming back. There was a good core of guys who had played significant minutes in Ivy League play. So that was a big thing. I think connected would be the word. That group of guys was very, very connected. Super talented also. They had two freshmen on that team, Devin Kennedy and Miles Stevens, who are now 1,000-point scorers.
Mm-hmm.
So they were talented as supporting roles at that time and grew into their career here. So it's paired with, you know, Spencer Weiss and Steve Cook, who were first-team All-Ivy as seniors, to have supporting role like Devin and Miles, that really helped. So we were very talented also. And I thought there was just a competitive level that was hard to attain.
Mm.
They had gone 3 years without winning a title. That senior class did not want to leave here without winning a title. And everything about that year was like, are we winning a title? There's a great story. I'm not going to nail it right now because I'm on the spot, but I believe it's about a Great Britain rowing team.
Okay.
And so there's also a book on it. It's called Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? The basic premise is that year they decided they were winning an Olympic gold medal and they made all their decisions based off of that question. Will it make the boat go faster?
Mm.
And I thought it was kind of a great kind of slogan to go by. And I think that team did that without talking about the boat going faster.
Mm-hmm.
They basically said, is it going to help us win the Ivy title? And if it's not, then we're not doing it. And
right.
If it is, then we're going to do it. And I think that was a really, really strong point for that team that year. And I think trying to get back to that kind of mindset this year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in this year's Ivy tournament, I think you were a couple plays again from at least advancing to that final game. So you have a fairly young staff here. How is it to work with them? How do you guys work collaboratively?
Definitely a young staff. I think it's got a lot of positives to it. I think we all have a lot of energy. I think we all are very eager to grow and learn and sometimes like we're all very competitive and sometimes it doesn't get nasty, but it gets like we're going at each other, and good for us. Like, we better go at each other and challenge each other, because we're not all always right.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all want to feel like we're always right, and it's just a very ego-driven business. And if you don't have that confidence and you don't have that ego, you'll get squashed, and, you know, kind of at this level. So we all have it. We all feel very prideful in our work, and we have a very respectful level of competitiveness against each other. And I think it's what has really, really helped us all kind of grow. You know, Brett is so high level in everything that he does. And early on in my career, I would be like frustrated that he was like so much better than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, I'm very competitive, Mick.
Right.
And I'm like, and it used to drive me nuts. And early on, it almost like made me resent him a little bit, because I was like, he's so good.
Right.
Like, how can I get there?
Right.
You know, and it was almost unattainable to reach that. But really, like, directed my focus to understanding what made him really good and trying to adopt some of the things that, not having too much pride to admit, like, he's doing that, I should try to mimic that as well. I think when you get stuck in an office and stuck in a staff, if you're not careful, you start to compete against as opposed to with.
Mm.
And I think we're doing a really good job as a staff right now is competing together as opposed to against each other.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, obviously, you know, kind of steel sharpens steel, and it's when someone raises their level, and, you know, again, you have a competitive group, the other person's going to want to match it. And that's definitely beneficial. Like you said, making the boat faster right
yep.
there, you know? So, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier in terms of reads and things like that, but how do you, as a staff, feel, what's the best way to teach an offense or a defense? How important are sets as opposed to just letting your players have some freedom?
Obviously, a great question. I think building it is the answer to me, at least in my experience. And I think it goes on both sides of the ball. So when I was at St. Peter's, before I had gotten there, everyone talked about how, like, Coach John Dunn was a defensive guru, and like, you're going to learn so much about defense. And I don't know too many coaches that early on are like, oh yeah, I love defense, I'm going to be the best defensive coach. Like, I think you kind of grow into that. Everyone's kind of, oh, that's a great after timeout play. Like, every coach is kind of in love with the offensive side of the ball. So it was really good for me to be able to do that, go there for that year and learn from Coach Dunn. And I tell this story all the time. Coach Wagenblass and I are really good friends, and we talk on the phone pretty often. And I remember he was asking me, like, you know, how are things going at St. Peter's? And I was like, you know what, Tom? I was like, I think I'm fairly confident that we are the best team in the country at stunting off pin downs. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, Tom, we do it all the time. I was like, when the ball's at the top of the key and someone comes off a pin down, we are stunting at the elbow. We're the best team in the country at it. And it's all because we worked on it all the time. And when I got there, I saw how Coach Dunn built up his defense. And we started in how you move as an individual, how you move in 2-on-0, how you move in 3-on-0, build it into 4-on-0, and then all of a sudden we're in a 5-man show. We shelled actions out of 2-man. We shelled it out of 3-man. We would go over every action you could go over. We'd go over a screen to screener. We'd go over a pin down, how you lock and trail it. We would go over everything, and it would all be in small portions. And you would teach the actual action first, and then in a broad spectrum, you would get into how it would look in a game. And I think it really, really helped us as we got into the season, because, you know, no one's inventing a new offense. You know, basketball will be played differently, but it's still, you know, 3-man actions and 2-man actions. Is it a pin down? Is it a pick and roll?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's really not a new way to play. There's kind of just different styles. So at some point during the year, we would always fall back on what we were doing in September and October, which was building our defense in those 2-man and 3-man defensive coverages. And then when we would face a new team, you know, if you're facing Lafayette or you're facing Iona or Manhattan back in those days, they would do different things, but we would always fall back to what we had done and introduced in the beginning of the season. So I thought that really helped me learn how to build a defense and how to to coach a defense. All the stuff that we were coaching, you can have a different ideology of how you want to do it. You can say, I'm going under every screen instead of locking and trailing it, but you still should shell how you're going under the screen. If you're going to X a screen the screener, you should go over how you're going to exit in a two-man, in a three-man, before you introduce it to a five-man. Because in that situation, you're going to have two other people who are doing nothing. They're right. just going to stand there and watch, and they're not going to get to see how it happened, and they're not going to get the reps. So building it from a two-man and three-man situation, I think it goes for both sides of the ball. That's what we do here on the offensive side, and we do it also now defensively as well. We do a lot of 2-on-0. We do a lot of 3-on-0. And then we build it into 2-on-2, and we build it into 3-on-3. So in terms of how much freedom do we give, I think you got to have a structure. You got to have a concept. You have to have not a rule, but you have to have kind of a guideline. Can't run your own offense. Coach loves that line. If someone does something that like we've never taught them or we don't like – encourage them to do, he'll be like, oh, you're making up your own offense.
Right.
So it doesn't happen often. Like, you have to be really off the rails for him to say that. But there's definitely a way to play, and we teach our guys that in 2-on-0 and 3-on-0. And obviously, like I said, we build it into live action 2-on-2 and 3-on-3.
Let's talk scouting a little bit, because I know, and having had conversations with you before, statistics, obviously, I think one of the things you mentioned at some point, believe it or not, there's some really smart people with statistics around this campus.
Yeah, for sure.
So are there any statistics that you as a program value over others, like some that are really important to you?
So we talk about points per possession a lot here. We value that. So we'll do like 10 possessions in practice, and then we'll see how many points we scored in 10 possessions. And usually a good barometer on that is if you get 10 points in 10 possessions, like, it's okay. You're always shooting for 11 and 10 or 12 and 10. And if you can get to 14 or 15 and 10, like, you had a great session. And then obviously flip side defensively on the side of the ball, we're trying to get it to 8. That's like really, really hard to do. But that's our goal. I think if you're keeping teams to 0.8 points per possession, like, you're in really good shape as long as you're not airballing every shot that you take. So as a program, we value that. I am an absolute nut about layups. So what our field goal percentage is in the paint, it means a great deal to me. And I portray that and inflict that onto our program. And we'll be in practice, the office plan in practice, talking about it. And coach will be like, what else do we need to do? And I'll be like, layups. And I say it all the time. And he gets tired of me saying it, but he knows that we have to do layups. I remember I always used to go crazy when I coached in high school and people would be like, oh, we're missing easy layups. And I'm like, well, do you practice those layups? And they'd be like, no, we don't practice layups. It's a 2-foot shot. I'm like, well, if you don't practice it, you can't get mad at a kid that's not going to make them. So how are you making layups? And layups are also post moves. They're also like mic-ins and hook shots and up and unders and all that stuff. So how many solutions do you have when you're at the rim would kind of be my thing. So I'm constantly looking at our field goal percentage in the paint. And then within the course of a game, we're lucky enough to get live stats during the media timeouts. And I always look at our assist numbers. I think it's huge. I think if you really, really look at it, I know the Golden State Warriors are kind of, some people will say, on the downslope of their quote-unquote dynasty, but they were like 28th in the league for a long time on isolation plays. They share the ball better than anyone in the whole league, and there's a reason for that. So I think teams in the NBA are starting to count passes. Unfortunately, we don't have the resources to do that. So if you're counting passes, usually you're going to get two assists as well. So I always kind of look there, but we really value defensive rebounding. Lucky enough, Coach Henderson has put an emphasis on that, and we've been top 50 in the country for a large portion of his tenure in defensive rebounding percentage. So, meaning we're not giving up a lot of offensive rebounds. So, those are the things that we kind of talk about here, both me individually and then collectively as a program.
Okay, so a lot of people talk about, you know, coaching the whole person. So what kind of people do you guys want to produce here as a program, as a coach, and how do you go about that? So a guy graduates Princeton after 4 years, walks out of the basketball program. What kind of a person are you looking to see?
I think this place is going to produce a well-rounded individual, not just from the basketball perspective, but they're getting such a great education. Everything they're being introduced to, I think you obviously hope you're producing a well-rounded individual. And a lot of the work has been done before they get here. You know, we're getting a lot of kids that have great parents and great home life, and they've shaped them really well. And we're just trying to, you know, maybe straighten it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's too much of us shaping that. I remember when I was coaching in high school, I felt like I had a lot more say in how are we really going to set these kids off on the right foot. I think that's where a lot of the molding goes on, and you can be very influential in their life then. Now it's more kind of participating in their life and just trying to maybe talk about your experiences and as an adult a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I think when the kids are in high school, they're not as willing to listen to like, hey, this is what it's going to be like when you get out of here. Cause they're like, I have 10 years before I need a job, right? Coach. Like, come
right
on.
Relax.
Now I think our guys are starting to are very receptive, and especially at this place, like they're very in touch with society and how things are going on and behaviors and whatnot. So they're very well rounded in that sense. I think we're looking to have gratitude from our players. Mm. I think at Division I college basketball specifically, there's a lot of ego. There's a lot of stuff on social media now where kids have a highlight tape if they play in a pickup game in New York City. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much attention to these players. And I think we're trying to have kids be very gracious and appreciative of what they have and what this place is and what it's like to be a part of it. We're very lucky to have all of these departments here that are helping men's basketball. Like I said before, like, I have a marketing department. We have business, equipment, you know, PVC. There's so many people, donors, alumni, fans, parents, like there's so many people that are doing so much to help us. And I think it's really easy for Division I athletes to take it for granted. Mm. Just off the top of my head now, yeah. Like our court is getting the new line put on it. We're getting it moved back to the FIBA line. And that costs a lot of money. And like, it's just taken for granted that like, well, should be done. Well, like, no, someone's in there working on it. Someone took the time to plan it. They had to schedule it. They had to make sure it's getting done the right way. Like, our guys don't see that enough. Mm-hmm. And I think we try and do a good job of letting them understand like, hey, this machine doesn't just go. There's people that are kind of pedaling it along. So I think if we're getting gracious players that leave here, I think caring people, you always want to have caring people around. Like, and we do that by demoing it. Mm-hmm. I think Coach Henderson does a great job of being very gracious for everything that gets done here. He has a great deal of respect for the university, both in the athletic department and up campus in the administration. So I think the modeling is very important, and we kind of follow his lead. He does a really good job of setting the tone for us, and however we act is how we think our players are probably going to act, just kind of model behavior. One of the things I always kind of try to talk about is like the three P's is one of my things that I try and do. And you should always be pursuing them is kind of what I talk about. So I think you should be pursuing perfection, like try and strive for perfection. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to get it.
Right.
But I think the pursuit of it is really, really important. I think the pursuit of perspective is really important. Always kind of like understanding where you're coming from and what kind of situation you're in. Like, that's really, really important. And then obviously passion. Like, what are you passionate about? So if you can pursue those three things, I think you're setting yourself up in life for a pretty good experience.
Yeah. You know, and I really like the perspective part, because I don't think you hear that a lot, is thinking about things from different perspectives and considering other people's, where they're coming from. And I couldn't agree more with you. So one of your guys is down, you know, like he's not real confident, maybe had a bad game shooting, maybe got a bad grade on a test, whatever the case may be. How do you try to like reinstill confidence into a guy that you see is struggling?
It's an interesting question. I think like there's a lot of stuff on mental health now. So you have to always think about that. And if you're not reading into it and understanding kind of what's going on with the kids in society these days, you're not doing yourself a service. Like you need to understand kind of that. And I'm no mental health professional, but you have to be at least in tune with kind of where that stuff is at. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a little bit of a pulse on what that player is that you're talking to. So I think every kid is kind of different. You might have someone who's a little bit more sensitive, so maybe that approach is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the general theme for me is this might be outside the box, but I think the word is honesty for me. Like everyone always wants to be like, oh, you got to like pat him on the back and coddle him and make him feel like he's important. And that'll bring his confidence back up. Like, I think if you're honest with them and you get them to realize the honesty of the situation, whatever it is that they're in, their shots aren't going in or whatever. Like, well, why aren't your shots going in? Are you getting extra shots up? No? Okay, so whose fault is that? Like, be honest with yourself about the situation. And sometimes things are happening outside of their control, right? Maybe something at home happened. Maybe something with a relationship happened. Maybe, you know, I don't know what the case may be. So honesty about that.
Mm.
And like, hey, man, like, this is just a patch. Like, you got to go through it. And adversity makes you stronger. Like, I've talked to some coaches around here. We have some good one-on-one talks like in the department. And I always talk about the advantage of adversity. Like, I feel like I became a better coach because I had no connections and I had no experience. And like, it was really, really hard for me to get all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And me having to go through the ringer to get where I am made me like on fire to learn because mm-hmm. I'm like, I need to grow. I need to do this. I need to do that. And if I had it handed to me, I don't know that I would be as refined as I feel like I might be now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's still a lot of room for me to grow. So I think being really, really honest with people is kind of my advice. Like we've had players down before and I just try and have an honest conversation with them and try and get them evaluate their situation and get them talking and talking about what they're feeling and what they're going through.
Right. And you know, you can be honest. If we go back earlier, if you built that relationship with that kid, then, you know, they trust you and they know that ultimately, Manja has my best interests in mind here. And he's trying to get me through this. And
right. So I had a conversation with one of our players, in the springtime. And it was an organic conversation. I did not plan on it happening. We were at lunch at a dining hall. It was just me and him. And somehow we just started talking and we talked about his performance and stuff like that. And we just had a really, really honest conversation. And if I had that conversation with another person on our team that I didn't have a greater relationship with,
mm-hmm.
I could have ruined my relationship by some of the things that I brought on the table in that conversation. But the fact that I had built that relationship and it was solid and the foundation was really, really mm-hmm. strong. I'm hoping that it might've turned the corner for this particular player on our team,
mm-hmm.
that we had a really, really difficult conversation and it was really, really productive. And I think from that point, everything that I've seen is that he's kind of growing and hopefully trending upwards.
Nice. So let's say playoff time right around here, which is big. So now, and we'll get you to weigh in a little bit on this. So it used to be the regular season determined who was going to get the automatic bid to the NCAA tournament for Princeton or for the Ivy League. Now there's a final. There's a just the Ivy tournament.
Yep.
Calling it
top
Ivy,
four teams.
Ivy Madness. Yes. Is that like kind of
the
nickname of it? Right. So what is different about – so you get into Ivy Madness and, you know, the year when you guys ended up winning – you won the regular season and then you had to play that tough first game. The first game was against Penn, right?
Correct.
You guys were really good.
Yep.
And and then this year, again, you guys played Yale, I believe, right? So how are preparing for those games different? Because in this league, you guys have seen each other, you know each other inside out. So how is the approach different down that end of the season?
I think the emphasis on execution, it just gets heightened in those moments. I know that everyone always says that playoffs feel different. And I think to an extent they do because it mentally in your head, you know that sometimes it's a win or go home mentality. Mm-hmm. And you can argue back and forth whether or not that mindset's detrimental, whether people put too much pressure on themselves because it's win or go home. I think every kid or every player, every coach, like they want to win every game. It's just a matter of how much you execute in kind of those key moments to make those plays when you need them the most. Like we know every player on every team by that point. We've played them twice. We've been watching them all season long. Like we don't play Penn until January 4th this year. Like we will watch Penn all year. You know, November 5th, whenever they have their first game, like to some extent we will tune in to watch it. Like we're going to know their personnel. We're going to know what they do. And the same is going to go for them to us. We're all going to know each other. And in the toughest of moments, how are you executing in those moments? And it goes back to the situations that we were talking about. How prepared are you for those moments? It's just replaying in my mind over and over again right now, our game against Yale, where we messed up a ball screen coverage with like a minute to go. And Blake Reynolds hit a three at the top of the key, which kind of broke us. It broke our back. We were, you know, that's, we never recovered from that play. And in that moment, we didn't execute and Yale did. And that was the difference in the game. You know, you can say whatever you want about the whole ebbs and flow of that game. We were down by 14 at halftime. All of a sudden we had, you know, a 5-point lead with 3.5 minutes to go. So it was anyone's game. We knew each other. We went back and forth. We had a game of runs. But in the toughest of moments, we messed up a coverage and Yale didn't. And they took advantage of it and they made a play. So that's really what it comes down to in the playoffs. And that's kind of the mentality. I've heard some people talk about, they've referenced this documentary. I'm so bad at remembering things while I'm being recorded on a podcast, Mick.
Well, what was the documentary?
Documentary about? On like a rock climber.
Oh, Free Solo.
Free Solo.
Yeah, the guy who climbed El Capitan.
Right.
With no ropes.
So that's like the mentality in the off season, in the postseason. Like in the regular season, you're playing.
Right, yeah.
And you have a rope.
I like that.
Because you're, you know, you're playing, you lose a game, it's not the end of your season. But in the playoffs, there's no rope.
Right.
So, like, you can't be afraid to play without your rope.
Yeah.
You just got to go and climb it and be confident. And, you know, in the documentary, he doesn't die. So, I guess he won the championship. But
well, it's funny because – it's funny that you mentioned Free Solo because Bill Walton, who, after you guys had that tremendous win at Arizona State this year, after Arizona State had just beat Kansas, who was number one in the country – Bill Walton, I was watching him do a Pac-12 game late at night, and he constantly was talking about Free Solo.
Really?
Like throughout the whole broadcast.
Bill's our guy.
I know.
Bill's our guy. 2 years in a row, we've beaten a Pac-12 team, and he's come into our locker room and give a speech after. So he's a big – his son's a Princeton alum.
Right,
so
yes.
He's a big Princeton fan. Yeah. We're excited.
Well, and I'll give a quick shout-out to Hard Cuts because that's where I saw – I watched the one episode, that episode where you guys beat them, and then – in that episode, they showed him coming in there, and everybody was like, "We want Bill and stuff." Man. And
that was great.
Yeah, so that was really cool. But yeah, he's a huge Free Solo guy. He throughout the course of a basketball broadcast, I forget which game, it was like Oregon. I forget who they're playing, but he brought up Free Solo at least 5 times.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
So no, he's definitely painting with a different brush right now. What advice would you give to young coaches coming up or, you know, let's just say guys who are trying to break into the collegiate ranks? You know, I'm sure that there's people who are going to be listening to this who have ambitions beyond high school. What advice would you give to them?
Sure. I think number one is you touched on it earlier. Open yourself up to as many experiences as you possibly can. So when I got into it, I had no connections at all. And I just listened to people who had been through it. Tom Wagenblass was telling me to work like this camp, that camp, camp over here, camp over there. And I tried to work as many of them as I could. I was working camps in Harlem and, you know, trying to think Neptune for Hoop Group. Mm-hmm. Like I was going to Poconos. I was going to Elite Camp in Albright. Like I was doing all these tournaments and camps to just try and get my name out there and also getting – starting to form a reputation for yourself. Like when I worked those camps for Hoop Group, like it's a job interview because you never know who's going to know someone. Mm-hmm. You never know who at one point is going to be a coach that can get you a job. So when I was working as a young, I don't even know, I think I might have been at Riverdale. I worked Rutgers overnight camp, and I was trying to get into college. It was my third year at Riverdale, so I was going back for one more, but I was still just trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. And I was asking all these guys tons of questions. I was like the least qualified coach there. Everyone else was like a really good college player, a GA at a school or assistant coach somewhere. Like they were all way more qualified than I was. So I was just trying to learn. And a couple of the coaches like rubbed me off and didn't really want to talk to me and like thought that like, oh yeah, yeah, we know you. And mm-hmm. you're just some guy who wants to coach in college. Like you don't really want it.
Right.
And fast forward to like when I got the job here, some of those same guys were like emailing me and like, hey man, congratulations. Like,
right, right.
Knew you could do it.
Right.
And I was just like, you played yourself because
I
remember you. Yeah. Like, you know, I remember that guy
who
want to give me the light of day.
Right.
So you just never know who you're talking to, who's going to get that next job. One of the guys who I worked camp with at Rutgers is a Division III head coach now. He's a young guy. He's like 29 years old, 30 years old. But like him and I got along really well at that camp. And like no coincidence. Like he pursued his passion and made it happen for himself. So open yourself up to as many experiences as possible. I think experimenting and failing is like super, super important. I think we talk about how well prepared I thought I was when I was coaching at Riverdale. Confidence was really key because I portrayed myself like I knew what I was doing, but there's a lot of things that I know now that I could have been doing way better had I gone through that a different way. So I think experimenting and having that platform to do something and fail and learn from your mistakes is going back to the adversity, the advantage of adversity, like learning from a situation that maybe didn't go the right way. I think that's really, really important. So if you can get into a situation, it's not always easy as an assistant, especially at the high school level, to get that platform to fail. But I think it's pivotal in someone's development. And then if you're specifically – that's kind of like all coaching in my opinion,
okay,
no matter what. But if you're specifically trying to go to the college level, I think you have to do all those things. You have to go and work camps where college coaches are. Hoop Group's been a great resource for that, for getting some coaches started in their career and networking. Go to college practices, email coaches. We get emails all the time, so don't email me. I don't need any more in my inbox. Just kidding. But go to practices, introduce yourself to coaches, follow through. Like be a yes guy. If someone provides you an opportunity, you know, if you're not prepared for it, say yes and figure it out.
Great point.
It's something that like I remember I wasn't prepared to coach AAU. Like I had no idea what I was getting myself into, but I was like, this could be huge. Yes. Now I'll go figure it out.
Right.
So that was really, really big for me. But do all those things, go to college practices, go to clinics, take notes, introduce yourself to A, the speaker afterwards, and B, look at some shirts while you're in the crowd. Like maybe there's a college coach there that you can connect with and talk to. One of the most commonly done things that I know doesn't happen enough is if you go to a clinic, every coach will be like, here's our email address or here's the secretary's phone number. If you need anything, call this number or email this person. Like 75% of the people don't do that.
Right.
You got to be the guy who does do that and follow through with stuff. So just trying to get as many opportunities as you can and then just got to make one hit. That's all I feel like I did when I was trying to make it happen, mm-hmm. quote unquote, for myself.
Yeah.
It's just how many opportunities can I provide for myself, and then can I make the most of all of them? And if I do, I feel like if you put in the work and you put in the time and you're really dedicated and true to yourself, something good will happen.
Yeah. I mean, like we said, I forget who said it, but it's like the harder you work, luckier you get. You don't know when that next opportunity is coming, and that's it. I mean, I think you could take that and take it past sports, coaching, whatever. It
kind of transcends anything. Yeah.
Like business, whatever.
For sure.
All right. So here's the fun part. It's how we end it. This is the Around the World segment. Get to ask you a couple questions here about some of your favorite stuff.
Is this a trademark segment?
Yeah, this is how we close the show out here.
Around the World.
At Garden State Coachcast. Yeah. Around the World. So start off, favorite coach.
Wow. Favorite coach is Roy Williams. Yeah, I grew up a huge North Carolina fan. Obviously, Dean Smith was kind of at the really tail end of his career when I started to get into basketball. Kind of the Antoine Jameson years and all Vince Carter. So that's kind of when I started, but always was a Roy Williams fan to this day. Still try to follow the Tar Heels when I can.
Yeah, he recruited a kid from our school, and I've actually said this before on this podcast, but one thing about Roy, he came to see our kid, and we lost in the sectional final, and we lost by a point. And my buddy, who was the coach at the time, was obviously down as far as you could be, and Roy was walking out, and he just gave him a hug, and he's like, "I've been there, coach. You'll be all right." And he's like, "I'll talk to you soon." And he went out. And I thought that that really demonstrated his humanity, like really, and his understanding of, I know how this guy feels. And for him to do that really, to me, made him seem like very human. Awesome. So,
that's really cool.
Favorite athlete?
Favorite athlete? I guess I have a couple. I would say
– go for it. You want to go Mount Rushmore? You can go Mount Rushmore. You want to go two? You go two. Whatever you want to do.
I would say – so I probably have three sports that I kind of follow, basketball, football, and baseball.
Okay.
So I grew up a huge Yankee fan. My mom and my aunt were diehards growing up. They still have a small season ticket package right now. So nice. They're big Yankee fans. So I grew up on Derek Jeter.
Oh.
Idolized him.
Yep.
My dad is a big, myself now too, are Indianapolis Colts fans.
That's right. I remember you saying.
So he had season tickets when they played in Baltimore and stuck with them through all the years. Mm-hmm. So grew up a huge Peyton Manning fan. And then always was a Kobe Bryant fan.
Kobe, huh?
Yeah, Kobe through and through. Always appreciated his game, obviously his approach, and now is well-documented. Mamba mentality. So I feel like I had a really good kind of role model group that kind of, in a weird way, might have shaped me. You know, yeah. The way that Derek Jeter always handled himself with class, kind of Peyton Manning's work ethic and film study kind of latched onto that. And then maybe the competitiveness of Kobe Bryant all have a little bit of a wear on me.
Kobe, the craziest thing I ever heard Kobe say, this is, you know the movie Saw?
Yes.
And they put the key in like the person's eye and they like whatever they, I don't even know how they get it in there. But Kobe said, he's like, "I think I could get the key." He's like, "I think," like, "I don't doubt it either."
I believe that.
Pre-game routine.
Pre-game routine. How? Like right before the game or?
Yeah, whatever, you know, right before. I mean, you know, you got the butterflies going. I'm sure you have responsibilities you got to do, you know, is there something you do to calm yourself down? And, you know,
I like to listen to music before games.
Okay.
I think that would probably qualify as my pregame routine.
Are you going like high energy, like let's get the battle going, or are you bringing it down to like a calm level? Like where?
Oh, man. My playlist is very extensive. I have a very wide range of music I listen to, but honestly, before games, I'm more of like relaxed music.
Okay.
I don't think I have to calm myself down, but I think like the game for us as coaches is not about getting pumped up. It's probably more about just being like
right.
level-headed, see the game, react to the things that happen, be in a good state. So I listen to like laid back, relaxed, you know.
Give us a jam. You gotta give us one.
So I used to listen to Michael Jackson before games.
Okay. Yeah.
Kind of like happy.
Yeah.
Get the energy going a little bit. Also, kind of surprisingly to people, I'm a big country music fan.
Okay.
So I listen to some of that. That puts you in a good mood.
Yeah.
I don't have a specific song that I listen to. I mean, when I was playing, I used to listen to like hip hop and
get some
vibes going. But
if you're from New Jersey and you play basketball anywhere from like 87 to current, you have some interest in hip hop music somehow.
Right.
Coaching quirk. So something that maybe little quirky, maybe like a tick you have, something that something that you repeat, like is there a phrase you repeat or, you know, something like hey, listen, in practice, I have to have this in this spot or it just, I'm not going to
feel right. You know what's funny is like I probably have a lot that I just don't even know about.
Right.
If you brought our managers in here, they probably would give you a long list of them. I'm sure our players. One of the popular things is our guys like to do impersonations of our staff and of each other, Like they're amazing at it. I don't know how they're so good at it, but they have like, even from the way that people dribble, they like make fun of each other. So if we called them in here, they'd probably give me the coaching quirk. I don't know that I have one that I can think of. I obsess over layups. So there's gotta be something in there about that. Like, I probably tell people not to hit the net, hit the rim when they're doing layups.
Right.
Like, stop hitting the rim.
Right.
And I can't stand the new jelly. That drives me nuts. So.
Well. That
might be my quirk.
I mean, I won't even comment on the jelly. I don't want to get myself in trouble here. I hate it, and you know, you can see kind of what direction that ultimately led to. My players or the players on the team would say, what about you?
Oh, man.
I know these are tough. These are tough, like looking
at me. We got to bring them in here. Yeah. You'll get the real answer. They're not shy. My players would say I care a lot about them and the program. And they would probably say I'm a machine.
Okay.
If I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Because they know how much coordinating I do, and they really appreciate it. Two of our players have spent the summer here, and they talked about how they had like a newfound appreciation for like how simple things are for them because I'm organized and it helps them out. So it was a great compliment to hear, but I don't know if they'd use machine, but something about like, just getting stuff done.
Yeah. You operate, even just with the camp stuff, you're on everything right away.
I'm sure
that's super stressful for you.
If you could see what goes on behind the scenes for camp, you would have a different, different opinion.
From the outside looking in, it seems like it's pretty tight operation. okay. Last one. Well, I'm going to give you one more after this, actually. After a big win, your victory meal is what?
Oh man. So we usually have pregame meal predetermined.
Okay.
So, it's usually picked out in advance. I usually pick it for myself. We kind of order our own stuff. So we've been doing On the Border a lot. So we get a little bit of a Mexican bowl, which is great. I love Mexican. But when you ask that question, I'm just going to pretend that we don't have it ordered.
Right.
And I'm going to say two things, either buffalo wings or chicken parm.
There you go.
Those are the go-tos.
I think you're like the fourth person who said wings.
Oh, yeah.
Out of like six.
I will challenge all of them to a wing eating contest if you want.
We might have to, after season one wraps,
we
might have to have the celebratory one. Last one I'm going to give you. You're reading 25 pages a night. Give us a book recommendation.
Oh, this is great. Always my answer.
Go ahead.
The book is The Way of the Shepherd.
Okay.
It's the best book I've ever read in my life. I always tell people like I didn't read books in high school. I like refused to read. I hated reading.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I started to get into coaching, I knew I needed to grow a little bit and learn some stuff. Been listening to some people say like, you got to start reading and whatnot. So try to get into it. The Way of the Shepherd, it got delivered. It's like a small book, really quick read. I read it in one day.
Okay.
That's how good it was. And I've read it multiple times over and over again. It's a fascinating book. Highly recommend it.
Interesting. And that's the second time. I know over the summer, Josiah, one of your assistants, recommended the book, and he said he got it from you.
Yeah.
So I need to check it out. Well, Monj, it's been great. Thanks for sitting down with me here. I think people are going to really learn a lot from this podcast. Hopefully they have a new appreciation for what a director of basketball operation does. And so thanks a bunch for joining me. And Garden State CoachCast, over and out.
Thanks, Mick.